You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
In San Francisco, and this is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up in the next hour, tech stocks turn sharply lower as the semiconductor slowdown takes the industry down with it. We're going to have more on the warnings from chip makers and when we might see a recovery. Plus, the gig economy faces a new reality after the Labor Department proposes some gig workers be classified as employees, sending shares of Uber down more than 15%. We're going to talk about what it means for Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, and more. And we get a glimpse into Mark Zuckerberg's vision for the metaverse. The company is leaning into the virtual workplace with new partnerships with Zoom and Microsoft. Zuckerberg also unveiling the new Quest Pro headset and showing off his avatar legs. Hundreds of billions of dollars have been wiped off the chip industry following a worldwide drop in demand. For reference, Taiwan Semiconductor, the most valuable chip maker in the world, suffering its biggest drop since 1994. For more, let's bring back our Bloomberg Intelligence senior analyst, Woojin Ho, who's been, of course, following all the moves in chips. And you know, Woojin, we were talking about a potential glut in supply for months, but it seems to have taken everyone by surprise. Just this idea that we didn't have enough and now we have too much. You know, why has this all happened so fast?
Sure. So thanks for having me on again, Emily. So a couple of things, right? I think the recessionary environment, the recessionary concerns going into 2023 have really started to hit the end markets, servers, PCs, TVs, so on and so forth. Any electronic goods, that seems to be paring back. And we saw evidence of that last quarter with respect to AMD and Intel. They made their first round of cuts. And I think what surprised everyone else is that when we thought it was over, there was another round of cuts by Micron as well as AMD. And then layer that on with the geopolitical risk, which is also weighing on TSMC.
Mm-hmm. So would you say a downturn in chips is a leading or lagging indicator for the rest of the technology industry?
Sure. So why don't I take you back into history? If we look at pre-COVID, the chip makers has always been an early cycle industry. And they were the first one to come down once COVID hit. But once we figured out that COVID was not going to be as bad as initially thought, they were the first ones to come back up from a valuation perspective, right? It's going to take a while for estimates to catch up. So I know that there were a couple of rounds of cuts on the chip sector already, but even at 14 times, it's still not at trough multiples going back to 2018. It's still 17% premium to trough multiples. So there still may be another round of earnings cuts to reflect 2023 expectations.
Which companies are in the worst position based on what chips they make and what is most, you know, in oversupply?
Sure. So if we think about it from an end market perspective, companies that are over-indexed on the consumer side are hurt And one of the reasons why TSMC is hurt so badly is because some of the leading chip manufacturers rely on TSMC as fabs. And think about it, Apple, smartphone manufacturers, as well as AMD for their PC chips. So those three buckets alone is going to create that slide. I think if you think about companies that manufacture their own chips, you have companies like Analog Devices that do not have as much consumer exposure, but they do have a fair amount of consumer exposure as well that may see a negative impact, as well as companies like NVIDIA that's already warned on weakness on the consumer side.
All right. Woo Jin Ho, thank you for helping us work through all of this new information. Our Bloomberg senior intelligence analysts appreciate it. Meantime, a new proposal from the Biden administration would classify millions of gig workers as employees rather than independent contractors. That could have extreme repercussions for companies like Uber and Lyft, which plunged on this news. Let's bring in Bloomberg's Jackie Davalos. So Jackie, tell us exactly what this new law involves and how it would impact the companies that you cover.
So the proposal, which is still being considered, is essentially a new outline for how companies can determine whether their workers are independent contractors or employees, which carry certain legal and wage benefits, things like dental and medical. We all enjoy those as full-time employees. However, independent contractors like couriers and delivery drivers just don't have those same kinds of benefits. So this new proposal is effectively making it easier for companies to look at this certain criteria, some of it which has been refined from the Trump era rule that it's replacing, like how integral are workers to the business overall. You know, how much control do they have over their earnings? How much control do they have over how they can do their jobs? And these types of questions, which are really, you know, new ones compared to even the Obama era rule that it's mirroring, it's effectively more gig worker friendly. And Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, Instacart all have workers that have been clamoring for these types of benefits. So for them, it's certainly a positive.
So what happens next?
You know, there is a little bit of confusion around just how much of an impact this is actually going to have. And if you look at the statements that Uber and DoorDash and Lyft released, you know, they just weren't surprised. This is something that they were expecting since day one of the Biden administration. But what this really does, it's more of an interpretive guidance. So it's not going to wipe out the gig worker classification system. What it's doing is saying, look, this is how we're going to look at it from here on out. And it has more ramifications, say, in, you know, litigation. If someone sues one of the companies for misclassification, this is the basis that can be used now. For the companies, you know, we look at Uber, who's kind of had to deal with this in London when the Supreme Court over there ruled that they had to classify their London drivers as employees. So they're not totally new to kind of the impact of what it'll take if they have to switch the model around a bit. But it's certainly going to be somewhat of a hybrid from what legal experts as well as analysts are saying right now.
Meantime, Uber's former security chief, in another story dealing with some old legal issues, was found guilty of hiding information in a corporate hack attack dating back to 2016. You know, a pretty astounding verdict here. What was your reaction to this? What's been the reaction internally and within the industry to this in terms of what it means for corporate transparency?
You know, Emily, it's funny because that ruling actually, that trial was going ongoing while Uber actually had a recent hack for, it was their Slack systems had actually been hacked by someone. And it was incredible to kind of see the different reaction the company had. There was a blog post that outlined, you know, day by day what the updates were, what the impact were to customer data. And coming out of that trial, it's really two different Ubers now. The Travis Kalanick years really trickled down into just how the company held or handled corporate transparency. Now under new leadership, you've really seen that shift. The company is really, I think, more focused on just putting everything out on the table.
All right. So intriguing there. Bloomberg's Jackie Davalos will, of course, follow what's happening with this new law. Appreciate it.
We build Horizon Workrooms as a first step towards a virtual office in the metaverse. You know, it feels more like being there than any video call. You see more of people's body language, and the spatial audio gives you a sense of each person's place in the room. And you can have side conversations with the people sitting next to you or gesture without physically being there together. It's hard to fully wrap your head around this until you get to experience it.
Just some of Mark Zuckerberg's vision there for the workplace of the metaverse. And among other news at the Meta Connect event, Zuckerberg announced partnerships with Microsoft and Zoom to promote virtual collaboration, unveiled the $1,500 Quest Pro headset, and says Meta will add legs soon to avatars. There they are. Let's bring in Bloomberg's Kurt Wagner and Techonomy founder David Kirkpatrick. So, Kurt, what are your big takeaways today? Is it the avatar legs?
The avatar legs was a pretty easy one to point out and fun, obviously, a little bit better than just floating around in the metaverse. But no, I mean, the headset was sort of the flagship product that was announced today, this new kind of high-end VR device. You know, it's as Mark said in that video, it's more tailored toward working professionals. They're kind of going after a higher-end clientele than I think they have with some of their other stuff. But, you know, a lot of the technology that they kind of showed off toward the end of the presentation is the stuff, in my opinion, that's most interesting. You know, this is, for example, like lifelike avatars, right? Or even, you know, the ability to kind of use your hand or your wrist as a controller. All of that is very cool. The problem is it's just years and years away, right? So now you're asking people to be very patient. You're asking investors to be very patient as they build and work on this stuff. And so I think, you know, that's where the issue comes in. It's not that the technology is not cool. It's just it's really far off.
David, the stock dropped almost 4%. Why do you think that is?
Well, one way to look at it would be this is a company with 3.5 billion people in a business that's generating like $40 billion a year in after-tax profit that is talking about a business that for which they've sold 15 million devices and a metaverse product that has 300,000 users a day. And that's what the management is putting its primary focus on, it would seem. If you're an investor in a company that has such misguided priorities, I think you would be very disappointed.
Is the workplace, David, ready for metaverse technology?
No, not at all. No, it is not. It is not. It's simply not. We don't want to meet in the metaverse. It's very nice that Zoom and Microsoft have talked to Meta about possibly making a 3D version of their meeting products. But that is not what most people want to do. The company's behaving as if it was a gaming company. I mean, everything today was talked about as if it was a company for gaming, the kind of technologies are gaming technologies. It's kind of a gaming psychology, gaming aesthetics. But that isn't really what this company is. And it's a scary, scary situation this company has put itself in my opinion.
Hmm. Kurt, what's your response to that?
I think David's right. I mean, as I kind of alluded to there, right, the tech's cool, but can they convince investors that it's worth waiting 10 years for, right? And as David points out, like, they have a business here that needs attention right now, which is the advertising business, right? I mean, they're kind of dealing with a real serious threat right here and now with TikTok and young people not necessarily wanting to use their apps. And so when you think about that, that's the current state of the business, and then you look at, you know, what the priorities seem to be for Mark Zuckerberg, it doesn't necessarily align. And I imagine that there are a lot of people, clearly, I guess, given the stock movement today, that saw this and thought, man, why are they spending so much time and money on this problem when they have others that they need to be addressing?
Now, we spoke to Frances Haugen last week, of course, the Facebook whistleblower, and she had an interesting thought about Sheryl Sandberg leaving the company, and you know, the company now, you know, of course, being fully in the hands of Mark Zuckerberg. Take a listen to what she had to say.
You know, Mark has surrounded himself with people who tell him the same kinds of stories over and over again. You know, Facebook is just a mirror. It doesn't have responsibility. All these things that we're complaining about have always been present. We're just showing them to people. We don't play any role in this. We have no power.
David, curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I completely agree with her analysis of how they see this. I mean, to the degree Zuckerberg thinks about the sort of sociocultural impact of the products that he's built, he's still basically in the mindset of making the world more open and connected is really cool. And he thinks the metaverse is the next stage of that. He doesn't want to take responsibility for the ongoing problems that he has not resolved. And I continue to think that the reason the company changed its name almost exactly a year ago, at the height of Francis Haugen's revelations about numerous misdeeds and errors and unresolved problems, was to change the narrative, which to their credit was very successful as a PR move, but isn't really successful as a business move long term. And now they're stuck with a new name and an ostensible direction that isn't really rational. So they have such serious problems. And if any other company had these problems, the CEO would be out. But this is a company with no governance, with a board that is just a paper board because Zuckerberg completely controls it. He can't be fired. He controls all the shares. I mean, he controls a majority of the shares, so he can do whatever he wants. And that is a very dangerous situation. And it is dangerous for investors to be in this company, even though its PE is lower than any other major tech company by a substantial margin. It's not a good investment going forward.
Well, and that's in part because its market cap has dropped so much since Francis Haugen and since the company changed its name. This is now a $345 million company. David, how bad would things have to get before Mark Zuckerberg considers something as extreme as taking it private?
Well, you know that that's something that I have thought about as a possible remedy for the problems the company has, because then it could address the serious challenges it faces without the stock market breathing down its neck and judging it, you know, with the voting machine of the stock every single day. They have a lot of expensive problems to fix, and it would be a lot better to do it if they were private. But I think it would have to get a lot worse. I mean, look, the stock is down from almost $1 trillion to $350 billion now. It could go down to $250 billion, at which point I don't think it would be irrational for him to consider taking it private since he completely controls it.
Kurt, you know, we've talked and seen so much of their vision for virtual reality. What about augmented reality? How much farther does this go?
Yeah, well, we saw some glimpses of that in the headset, right? They're calling it mixed reality, but it's this idea that while you're wearing the headset, you can actually see the world around you. You can overlay graphics or digital objects on that world. And that's ultimately the vision that Zuckerberg has for AR glasses, right? That we might wear them. They'll look sort of like reading spectacles, but you'll wear those and that's how you'll interact without more, you know, not really a bulky headset. But, you know, I think that David's point here, what's interesting is like Mark Zuckerberg would probably tell you, hey, listen, you're betting on me, right? I have made, for the most part, pretty good business decisions for almost 20 years. And that's why he has control. And that's why people, you know, invest in this company. But over the last year or so, I think he's really raised some questions as to whether this is a pet project of his or whether this is actually a good, you know, use of you know, funds and attention. And we won't know that for like 10 years. And so that's, I think, the big trouble here is it's hard to say whether or not he's right.
10 years, very long time, especially if you're an investor thinking about the near term. Bloomberg's Kurt Wagner and Techonomy founder David Kirkpatrick. Thank you both. We're going to be right back with more of Bloomberg Technology. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks. Like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
More allegations in the Elon Musk Twitter battle. Bloomberg has learned that just before the billionaire revived his proposal to buy the social media company, he accused Twitter of ordering a whistleblower to destroy evidence. According to court filings, Peter Zatko said he burned 10 handwritten notebooks and deleted 100 computer files at the request of managers as part of a $7.8 million severance package. The SEC is weighing an investigation of Yuga Labs, the creator of the popular Bored Ape Yacht Club NFTs. Sources say the SEC is deciding whether the NFTs should follow the same disclosure rules as stocks. Bored Apes are among the most high-profile NFTs and have been traded for as much as $2 million. The SEC has brought dozens of cases against digital asset managers, including the $50 million fine to BlockFi back in February. Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. After VC spent years aggressively buying stakes in cash-burning tech startups, the current environment and cratering share prices of even mature tech companies have dimmed the prospects for startups that were working towards their own IPOs. What does that mean? What does the future hold for them? Let's talk about all that and more with Henry Ward, CEO of the equity management solutions provider Carta. So Carta has some fascinating insights into these pre-IPO companies. Henry, what's happening inside these companies right now and what's the mood like?
Yeah, sure. It's a tale of two stories here. There's the growth stage story where a lot of these growth companies are sort of in a frozen capital markets ring where they can't raise capital right now because they can't justify the prices that they raised previous rounds at. They're not willing to do down rounds because these rounds trigger anti-dilution provisions for early investors and it penalizes management. And so they're kind of stuck in limbo with these high prices that they priced, you know, 6 months, a year ago, but the public markets won't support and they're trying to figure out what to do. In the early stage markets, they're a lot more active. Prices are resetting quickly. We're seeing investors continue to be active. There's a lot of dry powder. And so it's a very interesting market. We see this in our business a lot, where early stage venture is still active. There's still a lot of deals happening, but growth stage venture is at a standstill.
What are you seeing happening with hiring and layoffs? We had a guest on, an investor a few months ago, who said he was expecting to see 2 to 3 million job cuts across the tech industry. Is that even close to happening?
Not even close. You know, it's really interesting. In H1 of 2020, when we saw the massive set of layoffs happening, we saw headcount growth among our customer base grow about 7%. This year, in the first half of this year, we've seen about 12% growth rate. So it's not as high as, you know, the boom years of 2018 and 19, where we were growing at 15 to 20%, depending on the year. But 12% somewhere in the middle. It's not as bad as 2020. It's not as great as 18 and 19. But we're still seeing a lot of startups grow, really being led by B2B SaaS businesses. So if you look at other sectors like healthcare, biotech, they're suffering a little bit more. But B2B SaaS continues to trend strongly.
So how do you square that with, we've heard from so many big tech companies, they're, you know, freezing hiring, slowing hiring down, they're being more deliberate. Do the numbers translate?
Yeah. So if you look, what's happening in the public markets is translating to the private markets. Is there's, you know, and earlier this year, there was sort of a massive capitulation of investors saying, hey, these all these companies are overpriced. We don't know which companies are going to survive, which companies are going to succeed, which companies aren't. And so they punish the entire tech sector. What's happening now is the emergence of investors deciding, well, they're, all companies aren't created equal. Some are more, will grow better and survive through this period, and others won't. And we have to sift through these companies and decide which ones are going to be the winners and which ones aren't. And what you're seeing is the bigger companies and even the smaller companies that are transactional revenue based, where the revenue can be volatile, are punished more by investors than recurring revenue or contractual revenue businesses. So when you look at like the great, you know, software businesses like Salesforce and Snowflake, where they have contractual recurring revenue and high net dollar retention and high growth rates, they're doing quite well. They're starting to recover, but you see other transactional businesses or business based on media or other types of revenue models, they're being punished more severely. And so you're starting to see a sector or a rotation between the high quality companies and the lower quality companies. And that's trickling into the venture world, where you're starting to see investors just be more selective in the business models that they're willing to support, rather than just support anything that seems like a great idea.
Meantime, Carta is expanding internationally. I understand you've bought 3 companies since June. How are you expanding so quickly in the middle of a downturn? Or is it that you're seeing some potentially opportunistic valuations out there and taking advantage or taking those opportunities as you see them?
Yeah, so last year we decided as a board and a company that we were going to get more aggressive internationally. We've always believed that sort of the problem we're solving is ownership in companies, and ownership's a global phenomenon, a global problem that we can solve across the world. Obviously, every region has its own nuances and regulatory requirements, and we're not experts outside the United States. And so what we've seen over the last few years, which has been really exciting for me personally as a founder, is all these Carta startups in different regions. So we found the Carta of UK, we found the Carta of China, we found the Carta of South Korea, we've found the Carta of India, we've even found the Carta of Africa, we've found Carta in all regions, and I would say almost every developed country now, we have some version of a Carta. Some founder has started a Carta for that country. And we've been talking to all these founders, and some of these founders, we've invested in their rounds, to help support them in their region. And then others, including the 3 that you mentioned, like CapDesk in Europe, Valbon in London, and then Zen Equity in India, we've actually bought the companies after getting to know the founders and falling in love with the team and the product. And really, their goal is to build out what we've built in the United States and build out for their region and their local market structure, and then start connect these things so that we have a global platform for equity management. It's an amazing time right now to do M&A. As prices are resetting, capital becomes more scarce. Founders are more willing to look at opportunities to join larger companies. We have a super active corp dev team. Obviously, as you mentioned, we've done 3 deals just in the last 2 quarters, which we're really excited about. Nothing to announce yet, but we've got more in the pipe as we look across the world and try to find the Cartas for every country and continent.
All right. Henry Ward, CEO of Carta. Good to have you back with us, Henry. Thank you for stopping by. Coming up, could NFTs mean the end of the password era for good? Unstoppable domains is next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Time now for our crypto reporter. We're taking a look at diversity in Web3 with the leading Web3 identity platform, Unstoppable Domains, which just announced a new goal to provide online courses on crypto and Web3 and distribute millions in NFTs domains to 5 million Latinas to help them build and control their digital identity. Senior Vice President and Channel Chief Sandy Carter joins us now for more on this. We're going to talk about that. But first, I want to talk about the whole password and username issue, which we've been using ever since the internet's been around. How is Unstoppable Domains trying to change that?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Emily. Unstoppable Domains presents a digital identity to every user. And that digital identity can be used to log into over 400 different applications, also be used to supplement email, do end-to-end encrypted email, as well as build a website. So it completely changes the model on its head, uses one way to get into an application, and then that digital identity travels with you and that data stays with you, which is such a powerful proposition. I believe that digital identity and that ownership is not just something that's nice to have, but is a human right.
So how realistic is this and how far off is it? A world where we don't have to use usernames and passwords at all?
So I think we're just beginning our journey. I like to say, Emily, that we're in the dial-up phase of Web3. There are so many capabilities you can already do with your digital identity and log into a set of applications, but the field is really limitless. I believe in the future we'll be storing healthcare data, education records, tickets, driver's license in there. So I think it's the right time to get started playing around and experimenting with your digital identity and to own it now. Since you own it, you don't rent it. It's very powerful to have that today as we're getting started versus waiting until it's too late.
I know you've also been incredibly active getting more women into Web3. You now have this announcement focused on Latinas. You know, talk to us about what this means and how you're hoping to increase diversity in this world for, you know, an increasingly important population.
Yeah, well, you know, we just chatted about how we're early. And because we are so early in this initiative, I think it's really important that we hear all voices. You know, based on data from McKinsey and from Deloitte, we know that diversity breeds more innovation. And right now, the population inside of Web3 and the metaverse is only 8% women. So we're not going to get that powerhouse innovation we need if we stay so homogeneous. Back in March 8th of this year, I announced an initiative called Unstoppable Women of Web3, whose goal is to educate that next generation of women and to help more women come into the space. And because, Emily, I had so many women ask me for that education in their own native language, that's why we're announcing today that we're bringing that education to our Latina population and providing them that education in Spanish.
Now, you know, we've heard a lot of people, Melinda Gates, for example, has expressed concerns about women backsliding as a result of the pandemic and now a macroeconomic downturn. We've heard concerns about this within the broader tech industry as well. Do you have concerns about women in crypto, women in Web3 backsliding or losing some of the progress they've made, you know, given, you know, these dreadful economic conditions that we're facing?
It's interesting. So I'm at Fortune's Most Powerful Women Conference today. I actually got to meet Melinda Gates and chat with her some about this. I think that the output that's coming out right now in terms of the amount of interest in Web3, you know, conferences, even this one here, so many questions about what is the metaverse? How can we play? How do we get started? Conferences around the world are just bringing in so much interest. So I think for Web3 and the metaverse, I believe that if we can provide the right set of education, that we can really accelerate the number of women in the space. In fact, the number of developers alone in the Web3 space has increased by 66% most recently. So with the interest, I think now is that perfect storm, you know, that early days where we can get more women interested, understanding what it is so that they can jump in and have a really big impact. And I think now is the time, given we are so early.
All right, Sandy Carter of Unstoppable Domain. Sandy, thank you for joining us. Today, Amazon's second Prime sale of the year. But the question on everyone's mind is it still a bargain? New research suggests maybe not. One of the professors behind that research is joining me now for more on this, Jinhong Xie, a marketing professor at the University of Florida's Warrington College of Business, along with our very own Brad Storn, who has, of course, covered Amazon for decades. So, Jinhong, tell us a little bit more about your research. The main thesis seems to be that the discounts aren't as big as you might think.
This is a research I conduct with my co-author, Sangshik Park at the University of South Carolina and Man Xie at the Arizona State University. We invested the products sold on Amazon, and we find this a new pattern of pricing in which the seller simultaneously increase price and displays list price and make announcement of a price discount. So in this way, a price increase is framed as a price discount. And seller, buyer saw the discount and they saw that they get a bargain, but actually they paid more than the consumer who bought before the seller displayed the discount.
Okay, so you're potentially actually paying more for something that you think you're getting at a discount. Brad, is this, you know, a long-time Amazon strategy, or is this something new?
Call it probably a long-time retail strategy. I don't know that it's necessarily unique to Amazon. I think you can see it in department stores and even discount stores. The idea of discounting something and making the discount kind of an illusion, inflating the actual retail prices is, I think, a tactic across retail. And I think it's probably harder to control at Amazon, given that more than half of those sales are going to be brokered by third-party sellers who control their own prices. It's probably something that's hard for Amazon to oversee.
Mm. Okay, to implement this strategy.
Go ahead. My question, Jinhong, is, you know, it seems like we saw some lackluster interest this second half of the year, and I'm wondering why that is. Is it because the discounts aren't really discounts? Is it because they already did this once this year? Is it because we're, you know, going into a recession potentially and people just don't have as much money to spend, Jinhong?
I think what I'm talking about is not that you didn't get a discount. It's you actually were charged a higher price when you were told you get a discount. So usually the seller display a list price or make a list price comparison when they actually drop price because of price promotion. They may not give you the discount they claimed. But in this case, the seller actually increase price and tell you it's discount. And then day or 2 days later, they will remove this discount claim and the drop price. So this is a very different.
So Brad, talk to us about the actual interest we saw this time around. You know, this whole idea to split it into Prime Days, you know, the thought was that would drive more interest. But I wonder if maybe it's not necessarily working.
I would say, Emily, it's probably a little too soon to say that today was a failure. I mean, remember, this is not a Prime Day. This is a Prime Early Access sale, and it's this new creature. It's hard to compare it to the summer sale. It's really weird timing, right? That no one is holiday shopping yet, or at least you're not if you're a normal procrastinator like me. Other big sales days like Cyber Monday and Black Friday are around the corner. The numbers we have really don't tell a consistent story. I think we can both tell that, like, Twitter mentions and chatter about this sale are down. There's one research firm that's saying that basically sales today, Clover is the research firm, were similar to the previous 30-day average. But then you have another firm, Numerator, saying that the average order size is way up and that the big sales, the big sale items are Amazon gift cards and Echo Dots, the small Alexa devices. So look, if the purpose of this for Amazon is to deepen its relationship with Prime customers and get more Prime customers before the holidays to kind of lock shoppers in, then maybe, you know, they can declare this a success as they move into the holidays.
Jin Hong, is there something that you think needs to happen here based on what you've found? You know, there has been a lot of scrutiny of the way Amazon prices certain goods, but, you know, not necessarily of the practice that you're talking about in particular. Do we need some regulation?
We think the attention is required to this new practice, because the regulation have been focused on the regulation on deceptive pricing has been focused on illegitimate value of a list price, you know, whether you use inflated or fake list price. But this is a different practice. This is a manipulation of the timing of list price introduction. So the seller synchronize the price increase with the list price introduction and the comparison. So that's a new practice, and this is really misleading for consumer.
Brad, what's your take on the signals we're seeing about shopping and consumer sentiment right now heading into the holidays?
It's tough, Emily. You've got the rising costs of food and fuel inflation. Folks are pulling back. There's no question that, you know, overall U.S. spending over the holidays is slowing down. Adobe, I think, said it was going to be about 2.5%. Previous years, you know, 8-9%. Of course, it was even higher because of sort of pandemic-fueled fear out of walking into stores. And retail's been kind of an anvil for Amazon. You've got a very successful advertising business, AWS, of course. Even some sort of successful business around third-party sellers and commissions. But retail itself, those online stores, they were flat last holiday season. It was down 4% in the last quarter. I think, you know, Amazon here, which has gobbled up share for years, decades, is probably not going to be doing that this holiday season.
All right. Bloomberg's Brad Stone, along with Jinhong Xie, professor at the University of Florida. Fascinating research from you. Of course, we're going to keep watching to see how this Prime Day unfolds. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Wednesday, we're going to have Amazon's head of Prime on to talk about Prime Day 2.0 and holiday shopping sentiment. And don't forget to check out our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.